History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. If you're a fan of history podcasts at all, there's almost a sure chance you've listened to Dan Carlin's Hardcore History, the original history podcast. Dan has been doing this a long time. He's famous for his interstate length episodes. It can go on for 4 hours, 6 hours. No one really dives in as deep as he does. He is a career broadcaster, and he manages to make history digestible, but also isn't afraid to look at one topic across a swath of thousands and thousands of years. And a lot of historians aren't too comfortable going more beyond a few decades. So Dan does a great job of that. That's why I'm so pleased to have him on the show. He was actually on it a couple of years ago talking about the differences between Germany's World War I and World War II armies. But this time he is here to discuss the topic of his new book, The End is Always Near: Apocalyptic Moments from the Bronze Age Collapse to Nuclear Near Misses. So this is a really fun episode because we bite off a lot. We'll jump around from Vikings encountering native peoples in the New World, the 1960 presidential election between John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon, where people are focusing on appearances and not nuclear war, the Bronze Age collapse of 1177 BC, where the Assyrian civilization collapse, the Egyptian civilization is mortally wounded, Hittites collapse, the civilization of Greece that supposedly fought in the Trojan War collapses. And there are questions here that stretch across history, like, do tough times create tougher people? Can humanity handle the power of its weapons without destroying itself? Will human technology or capabilities ever peak or regress? So this is a big episode that jumps all over the place, and Dan does a fantastic job of explaining all these things, as he always does on his podcast. Really enjoyed this. I hope you do too. So I hope you enjoy this discussion with Dan Carlin. Dan, welcome to the show. Really glad to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, well, this is something to ask because as of the date of this recording, it's March 2020, and 98% of news stories are about the coronavirus, and we're in pandemic stage as the World Health Organization defines it. You wrote your book before the coronavirus, and as you're seeing reactions in the media from the public, does it remind you at all from reactions in the past to whatever the coronavirus threat of their time was?
Yeah. If you look at the last era that reminds me of this era a little bit, everybody talks about it, the Spanish influenza, 1918, 1919, 1920 in there, and people were doing a lot of the same things. It's, you know, a lot of things change, but the people in this story are the one variable that sort of remains constant down at base level. And like I was telling my wife, everybody here in a way is just operating on the best common sense procedures, right? I mean, none of us wants to be silly. And we're, for example, stocking up just to be on the safe side. These all sound like logical countermeasures, but eventually nobody shows up for work and the truckers don't drive the groceries to the store and the whole supply system breaks down. And so it's funny that you could kind of be doomed here as a society in your economy anyway, simply following best practices and a nice cautious conservative approach. Looks like 1919 to me sometimes.
It seems like a feature that's hardwired into humanity, and something that I like that you do on your episodes that I think academic historians are shy about for whatever reason is to look at thematic issues across a sweep of humanity. And what I wonder is, just in general, why does this apocalyptic fear seem hardwired into humanity? And you can see this in any religion, and Ragnarok for the Norse, for Armageddon, Shiite Islam's belief in the 12th Imam, the Hale-Bopp comet, if I'm getting my doomsday cult from the 90s right. And this is intelligent people too. Like Sir Isaac Newton claimed that the end time would come in 2060 by his study of the Book of Revelation. So do you think it's anthropological, or what is this hardwiring into humanity of end time fear?
Yeah, I think we could speculate and have some fun with that. You know, such a dark topic, you could have some fun with it for a while. But I mean, I think about it like at the very base level. Let's talk about people 10,000 years ago living in an extremely precarious environmental situation, whatever that might mean, rival tribes, food supply issues, mortality from disease, anything. in a very strict sense, I mean, in the same way a lot of native peoples refer to themselves as simply the people, right? Your world is that world. They did face apocalyptic situations as far as that definition of the word meant to them, probably on a regular basis. So if we talk about hardwired because it's been like that generation after generation after generation, maybe you could make a pretty good case that it could be hardwired, and that precarious, always living on the edge of disaster existence from humankind, that's only been conquered in some places and relatively recently. So I think, I don't know, I'd say the evidence is clear, but I'd say I bet you could make a decent argument that there's something to that.
Yeah, and that's interesting where there, on the one hand, you have anthropology where this is the default human mode because we did live at the age of starvation for so long. But then there are actual systematic cases of collapse. And one episode that you touch on is the Bronze Age collapse, which I'm really fascinated by because it's like globalization before globalization and the system breaks down. Walk me through that, what happens, and then also how this ties into your bigger look at this theme across history.
Oh, well, the best, most accurate answer I can give on what happens is the Bronze Age, about the Bronze Age, and nobody knows. That's part of the fun. I mean, one of you had a giant apparent, you know, I was just going to say systems collapse, but that's just one of the theories. But when do you have something on that wide of a scale that's that disruptive and obvious, or maybe not even obvious? It's so huge and so long ago that we can still argue about what caused it today, but it really does almost look like a civilization 1.0 or a beta test of our modern sort of interconnected global supply systems and everything else that just almost... I mean, let me back up. I read a column once, and I used it in one of the early history podcasts about the Great Depression. It was from Robert Samuelson, who's an economic writer, writes for the New York Times, I think. And he had talked about how the systems that we used to have before the Great Depression seem so simplistic to us now, and all the mistakes that those people made seem so silly. And his point was, don't get cocky. We'll make our own new mistakes that will seem silly to someone down the road and who will learn from them. Maybe the Bronze Age is your first really good example of trying to build this house of cards system and us getting to learn ever since in some way, shape, or form how not to do it or how to avoid running into the same problem. I mean, some of the theories that I like about it are that it lacked any sort of flexibility, that it was a really rigid, dependent system, and that when some element of it, some major pillar or node or necessary component of it failed, the whole thing went down and there were no backup systems. I don't know which any of those theories are correct, but I don't know how you're not fascinated by something that large, that obviously connected in some sort of learning experience to modern times, and that allows you to throw in everything, including the Bronze Age version of like Viking theory, if you want to, into the mix. It's just, when you have that much uncertainty, you can project anything onto it, can't you?
Right. Yeah. I mean, we're basing everything on something in Egyptian hieroglyphs talking about sea
right.
peoples. Like, okay, who are these people? Yeah. It's just
Hittite records disappearing at a certain time. What does that mean? I mean, but at the same time, it is fascinating the number of disciplines that are now involved in trying to figure this out. And I mean, you wouldn't even think of all the specialties from volcanologists or, I mean, everybody's in on trying to figure this out a little bit. People who study tsunamis. The whole thing is, as an English friend of mine used to say about everything, bloody interesting.
Right. And an archaeologist friend of mine is looking at climate data to see about the Assyrian collapse. And I think there's some who think that when Homer is talking about the Iliad and discussions of dark clouds gathering, this is in 800 BC, a reference to 1200 BC and the collapse there. From that date, at least, I guess we're both fans of the ancient world. What were statements like that from the period that really jumped out at you that seem sort of timeless in their fear of these apocalyptic things?
Well, it's interesting because there's been so much work done on the Bronze Age, even over the last 30 or 40 years, that things that used to seem much more ominous when written in my older history books maybe seem a lot less ominous now. So like one of the things that used to be, and I think when we did our Bronze Age show, it was before some of the good modern books had just come out, but like the so-called clay records that were found still baked into the oven on some of these coastal towns that had then been sacked. And these were seen as evidence that these raiders that had been seen off the coast had come and sacked them before they could even be dried and sent these stone equivalent of letters. Well, now it looks like they just might have been buried in that building a long time afterwards, and maybe they had nothing to do with the Bronze Age Vikings, or maybe those people that they were worried about sacking their city weren't Viking types at all from somewhere else, but may have been their own people rebelling or their own pirates preying on their own people. So, I mean, those are the kind of things that force you to reevaluate how you thought you saw something like that ever since. And so when you say, which sources do you like the most, tends to vary depending on what I most recently read and what they think of them.
Yeah, the thing that surprised me the most of 1177 when this happens is that you can see one civilization collapsing for a war or a raid or people being hauled off into slavery or a localized famine. But for multiple civilizations around it, it's almost like a 21st century supply chain collapse. And that's just one idea. But so like an early Eastern Mediterranean globalization, it's so counterintuitive to what people would expect from that period.
You get the cascading effects, right? So that's when it becomes difficult to label any one thing, because let's just, for a single example, if you have a climate change problem that causes drought in one area, which causes starvation, the starvation leads to all kinds of disruption, because as we all know, most people do not choose to sit there and starve in place to the last person. They tend to move, and movement causes disruption. And so you have this cascading events where peoples, you know, that's the old theory, right? You have these migrations of full peoples that then bash into settled societies that compete for resources. But the whole point is to show that then that disruption, as you said, causes a supply chain problem, which destroys the whole, you know, trading economy of the region. I mean, the lesson here, if you want to take it to a modern analogy, is how reliant in a system everything is on everything else. What I keep telling my wife during the coronavirus thing is the time to panic is when we start making rules that don't let truckers deliver things, you know, from place to place. Then it does look a little like the Bronze Age to me. You start going, if there's nothing on the grocery store shelves, then money means nothing anymore. Then, you know, the very underpinnings of society start to fall away. And I'm looking for sea peoples on the horizon, you know?
Yeah, it's funny you mention that, because I think it's Richard Bulliott. He's a Middle Eastern historian and basically credits all of the rise of Middle East civilization with Islam and everything basically due to camels and the camel saddle. So they're like the truckers of the ancient world and the Silk Road too. So yeah, I mean, they're what makes things happen. I want to jump to a thematic issue and then we can jump around all over the place. In a lot of your series, in the Mongols series and a lot of them, you mentioned the quote from Voltaire. Can you remind me, it's the mankind walks down with silk slippers and goes up in wooden shoes?
Yeah, the sound of history is the sound of forever wooden shoes going upstairs and silk slippers coming down, or some variation of that. You know, basically meaning that the old life cycle of society's idea that goes back forever, that you know, the tougher, more hardscrabble ones are on the rise always, and then there's some sort of civilizational sweet spot between the Spartan existence that got you to the point where you could have a society with leisure time and plays and music and culture, and then from the sweet spot at the top of the pinnacle, you start the descent in the silk slippers downstairs to decadence and decay and sloth and all that, and you get overtaken by some other person coming up the stairs in clogs, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and you mentioned that with the Mongols, where you have hardscrabble Khans who are wearing rat fur versus four generations later, they're completely sinicized and speaking Chinese. And I study the Ottoman Empire, exact same thing with the sultans. The early sultans are celebrated as plunderers on horseback, and the later ones are just stuffed in their harem and drinking wine. And
sure, the old blue Turks back in the old days, right?
Yeah. And I mean, that's a tricky concept, but how do you see that play out? Because that's used until the 20th century, and then modern social historians don't like it, and you can't quantify it with data. It's conjectural, but just based on this theory of collapse and regeneration and everything, how do you take that concept of tough times creating tougher people?
Well, I mean, first of all, let's examine the obvious point before we even go there. And that's that there's so much romanticizing going on here about the mythical pasts of all these people. You know, I had somebody tell me recently that there, you know, that I'd said that there wasn't any contemporary sources on Genghis Khan's features and all that stuff, and they sent me some paintings that showed Genghis, and I had to say, no, that's not really, that's a romanticized, he was a white guy, by the way, with a nice big old long, and so you turn around, you just go, okay, we have to understand a little bit, like when the Ottomans are tracing their heritage back to the ancient Turks, were they? I mean, it's like today, I've often wondered, how much are today's Italians the Romans? You know, I don't know the answer to the question. I don't know, and I don't know how you would answer it. But so I think that's one question. Is when we romanticize, and this is something that people like you know a lot better than people like me. How often we tend to take an image. I mean, look, we do it today. I think being able to watch figures in your own lifetime have that treatment given to them gives you a good sense of how it used to be. I mean, look at how Martin Luther King has been squished into a two-dimensional cardboard cutout caricature of the three-dimensional human being that he was. Well, that's the treatment you give them all. That's what you give Washington. That's what you give Jefferson. That's what you give Genghis Khan if you're Mongolian. You know what I'm saying? This is so whatever it is you think you come from is probably a myth to begin with, and you've transformed that myth to meet your current situation somehow. In terms of the tough times and tougher people thing, well, you know, I don't have the answer to that question, but I am forever meditating on it, because it seems to me, and we talked about this a little bit in the book, and I think about it a little like coyotes. And one of the things human beings always praise coyotes for in an almost grudging fashion is their adaptability and the way that they seem to rebound from challenges in a way that, even if you want to get rid of coyotes, seems admirable in some weird way. But we praise ourselves the same way. We're an adaptable species. We don't have long fangs. We don't have sharp claws. We're not particularly fast. Don't jump particularly high. We're adaptable and we're smart. So does that mean we're adaptable in a toughness sense? And then I'm going to break that down into two senses. One being an evolutionary question of, do you get tougher from living a tougher lifestyle? But also an intelligence question, because if you really are intelligent and you really have to adapt to something, you're not just going to wait to grow longer claws and sharper teeth. You're going to push that with your intelligence all you can. So does, for example, if the Spartans decide they have to craft a society which is geared towards creating societal carrots and sticks, incentives and disincentives towards creating better soldiers for the survival of the state, is that your intelligence helping to bolster all of the cultural apparatus that they've set up into place to create, you know, almost their own eugenics system? You know, first we create these diamonds, then we polish these diamonds. I think there's an interplay going on there, right? So, you know, if you grow up in a culture where you're forced to fight a lot, get into physical fist fights, does that make you a tougher person? Well, it does if you're going to get into physical fist fights. Right. If that's going to be part of the criteria you're going to need in your world, then you're going to a few fist fights under your belt is probably a good thing to have. Right. If, however, we're raising somebody to go to Harvard today and work in a laboratory, I don't think you have to have those fist fights to adapt and to evolve to this society. The society does not require, I'm not going to say that level of toughness. I'm going to say that kind of toughness. So if to tie it into now, if we're going to exist in a situation where we're going to have viruses like this mutating every 3, 4, 5, 6 years and playing havoc on our economies and our personal lives and all these kinds of things, are we going to develop into more flexible people, more adaptable people? I certainly think we're going to make some changes to our global medical approaches after all this in response to it. Is that a case of society getting tougher, hardening the silos, so to speak? So, I mean, I see it maybe in a more complex fashion than just tough times, tough people. But I do think maybe that's a general umbrella that all those kinds of questions fits under, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does. That your grandmother who grew up in the Depression, who knows how to repurpose everything and doesn't throw away bread bags, for example, has an incredible resourcefulness, but maybe they don't have the toughness that a 21st century high school student would, where they can sit for 6 hours to study for the SAT and other things for early college entrance exams. So,
well, and another example, if my grandmother could go buy a replacement for that thing that would take her 8 hours or 9 hours and $4 to rebuild for $2, and it's right down the street at the store, does she really need that particular skill at that particular time? See, I mean, so it's all sort of context dependent. That's why the tough times make the tough people, if they do.
Yeah. It's a hard trope to give up to, because...
Oh, it sure is.
Yeah, like you said, in every ancient mythological count, there's this great figure who times have waned. There's King Arthur. There's Sultan Osman.
My favorite trope, King Arthur.
Yeah, I mean, you can just basically, I think it's a way for a court chronicler to criticize the current king, and whoever Arthur's enemy is the king, and they're kind of muttering on their breath and hoping he can pull one over the king. That's so many tropes to choose from, or just accounts like that of mythological people in the past. Gilgamesh, whoever you want. It's a huge grab bag. Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Something else, I'm excited to delve into this area because I'm a fan of travelers and explorers. So collapse or the end being near in terms of first contact between civilizations. I could see a lot of ways to go after that. There's the epidemic, there's smallpox, which makes coronavirus seem mild. But how do you look at this type of thing of some sort of massive shift if we're talking about first contact?
You know, it's funny because I do find it interesting the morality that's often attached to it, because I keep trying to figure out, you know, I guess the first thing I always try to figure out when I'm looking at those kinds of situations is what sorts of other ways might it have gone? You know, I mean, could you have had, for example, first contact happen and have it be positive in there? I mean, I guess what I'm trying to figure out is if it had happened the other way around. If the people from the so-called New World had found the people from the so-called Old World first and landed on their beaches, how different is it? Or if it had been, and you know, people theorize about this all the time, whether or not it happened, but if the people from Asia and places like China had discovered the New World first, in a sense where it wasn't like a one-time visit, but you establish regular communications, you get that pipeline going between the continents, how different does it turn out then? And all I can figure is, you know, forgetting the good, evil, slavery, religious, all the things that are overtones in that story, I think the disease is going to be the thing that's going to be there no matter what, and it's going to be the ultimate tragedy no matter how the thing plays out. So, I mean, you almost have to look at that as the equivalent of an asteroid that had Earth on a collision course long before any of us were here, because unless we can, and I'm trying to think, because maybe I'm just not smart enough, but maybe there is a way you get first contact and don't have the disease disaster. But if you do have the disease disaster, well, you're talking about a Holocaust, no matter what the intentions of the various people in the story, aren't you?
Yeah, I think it's with Native peoples in the Americas, it's something like 80-90% of death rate, if I have my numbers right.
They fluctuate. Different people have different ideas about that. Yeah.
And it's something like 30% with bubonic plague. So you don't have, I mean, that's what you have, whole scale social breakdown compared to tragedy, but that leads to reform like you would see there. Thinking about that, if you're looking at first contact where you have something devastated versus something like the Black Plague, I guess we can get into epidemiology since it's a big topic right now. Have you seen kind of changes like that on a sliding scale of 30% of people die in this population versus 80%? And how people perceive that and how they reacted to it.
Well, again, maybe I'm talking from ignorance here, but isn't that the situation with the AIDS virus? I mean, I think you see death rates in some places that don't even look modern anymore. But once upon a time, they were a lot more equalized. I mean, early on into the AIDS virus, there weren't huge differences in death rates in different locations. Now, if you look at the survival rate in a place like London or New York, and then look at a survival place that doesn't have medical care that's very good at all, I think you still get the 30%, 80%, or the 20%, 80% difference in terms of death rates or lifestyle differences. I mean, some people in the West hardly even, well, I don't want to say that, but I mean, it's so different than it was when it was a death sentence everywhere. And the real difference maker seems to be the level of medical care wherever you happen to be afflicted with it. Something that we said in the book, and it's not exactly on topic, but that I keep thinking about, is the particular nature of this epidemic versus other ones. Because we did have an epidemic in my lifetime. I think it's between 34 and 37 million people died from the AIDS virus. It's very interesting to see, though, how the more slow development and progress of that disease changes the impact of it. If you had lost the 34 to 37 million AIDS victims in a month and a half or in 3 months, instead of the way it was, and if everyone was affected and the transmission was through the air, and I mean, we already would have seen this movie that we're going through right now in the early to mid 1980s. You know what I'm saying? And I think that we dodged that bullet because of the specific nature of that disease. And I think we're dodging another bullet now, because I do think you're going to get reform from this. And I do think this, as bad as it might turn out to be, is nothing like an Ebola outbreak would be, or some hemorrhagic fever or something outrageously awful like that.
Talking about examples of first contact that maybe aren't whole scale social devastation, and I like travelers and explorers, and one that I like is Rabban Barsalma. He's a Chinese diplomat He is also a Nestorian bishop who travels to Europe in the 1200s, I think. He's like a reverse Marco Polo, the first person from China essentially to go to European courts. And no one really knew what a Nestorian was. And they thought he was like this Prester John guy, this mythical figure, these Christians out east. But when you're talking about first contact between civilizations, we think of the Age of Discovery, where conquistadors go to a civilization, they introduce smallpox, and there's
rape and pillage and all this stuff. Sure. Old world medieval values brought to the native.
Exactly. And then, and before we started, you mentioned with Mongol conquest. For Europeans, that's a different type of first contact, because I'm sure they would have had almost no knowledge of the Mongols, even though they share the Eurasian continent, but this wipes out their civilization as well. Basically, what are other examples when you were doing this that you thought of first contact that aren't necessarily like with natives being wiped out, whether it's Mongols or whether it's travelers and explorers encountering a native peoples for the first time, like a Captain Cook or a Marco Polo or others?
Well, not to be cynical, but sometimes it's not all about having a better attitude towards them or being more peaceful. Sometimes the first contact does not equal wiping out, because one side doesn't have the power to wipe the other side out yet. I mean, what about the Viking settlements in the New World? And you go, and if the sagas are to be believed, and if you're going to extrapolate like some people do from some of those things, they supposedly had contact. What did they call the natives? They called Skraelings or Skreelings. And they would fight the, and of course, in my mind, the idea of Viking warriors fighting Native American type warriors is an intoxicating clash of cultures. I love that. I'm berserk for that kind of stuff. But you think about that and you think, okay, theirs is not the conquistadore, convert and die, make slaves of the natives. It's not that kind of thing, but it's also not the benign, like we hear some of the stories of the, you mentioned one of the Chinese explorers to the New World. And there's all these stories about Chinese trees that have been found on the coastline. I mean, there's a lot of that stuff. It's been going on a long time, and I'm inclined to believe it. And those Chinese ships from the Middle Ages, which would grow its own food in the sunlight. I mean, I love all that stuff. But if it happens, one wonders why you don't keep coming back. You know, so I do know that there were changes in Chinese emperors, and that their outlook would change from a more internal focus and sometimes a more external focus. And sometimes that would happen right when the new big fleet was just finished to go to explore the Pacific coast, maybe. But I guess what I'm saying is if you're going to have the disease Holocaust anyway, then you're going to have the majority of deaths and sadness, I think, anyway. Then you're going to have, even if you have the Viking types that show up, I think that that only stays peaceful until there's an equilibrium between the two sides. And then I think you see the natural things that, well, I don't want to say the natural things that always happen, but I think for people who have a pessimistic outlook, it's always a lot easier to find evidence to back up your case. If you want to say that people are naturally going to start whacking on each other after a while for one reason or another. And as evidence for that, it's that the natives weren't exactly living in peaceful harmony all the time with each other, right? They're human beings just like everyone else. So you add new human beings to the mix, and I just think you add new contestants to the giant New World gladiatorial games. It might not be as one-sided, though, because to me, a battle between Vikings and Native American peoples looks a hell of a lot more equal than a bunch of conquistadores and their native allies against Aztecs.
Yeah, I haven't thought about that, Vikings versus natives, but yeah, now my mind is spinning. And when you mentioned Chinese explorers, I don't know if you've ever come across the book. I think it's Gavin Menzies about the, he thinks Zheng He discovered the New World in the 1430s and circumnavigated Greenland. And no way that's true, but I think it's a fun theory. I don't know if you've ever come across that guy.
You know, I like all those stories. See, here's the thing about, you know, I always describe myself as a fan of history, but there's some areas which I know less about, so I'm more of a fan than anything else. And one of them is the wonderfulness of Chinese history, because it is so long-lasting, as you know well, and so varied that you almost feel like you can find anything in Chinese history. Like something happened once, always. So when you look at how close they came at times to discovering and interacting with the world of the Romans, for example, during the imperial times, and how close at one point there was a famous Chinese general, and they always keep changing the Chinese pronunciation of these people on me. We used to say it was Pan Chao, now it's more Ban Chao, and he's one of these great generals that leads sort of a reconnaissance in force to go punish all these native tribes to their west, where a lot of the Uyghurs' problems are right now in the western part of China. And he goes and he's on this mission and he's subduing all these tribes way out where are these deteriorating Chinese fortresses even now on the old Silk Road. And while this was happening, the Romans happened to be advancing in that same direction from the other side. It was quite a bit of the stuff that they were dealing with against the Parthians. It would have been the Sassanids probably by then. And so there was a moment that all of the history geeks like yours truly love to play around with. And it's almost like when the Russians and the Allied forces meet up and shake hands in the Second World War. You have this meeting of the Imperial Romans and the Han Chinese meeting over somewhere in Central Asia. But to me, that would be an example of an interesting first contact, because unlike the Mongol version of it, which wasn't really first contact, but we know what we mean, or the New World one, a Han China and Imperial Rome at that time period, that's not a mismatch. You know, that would be an interesting sort of balance of power question right there, right? So that's two heavy undefeated heavyweight champions from other divisions finding each other. So now I'm geeking out over that in my mind.
It's amazing how trade networks cause things to happen and bring things in places you would never expect. Like Roman jewelry ended up in Japanese grave sites and burials. And there's a village in, I think, Western China that claims some of its inhabitants are descended from Roman soldiers.
The Roman legionaries. Yeah. From the Crassus debacle, right? Wasn't it that? I think it was the Parthian Crassus debacle, the lost legion or something. The lost cohort.
Right. And then we have more Western features. So that definitely proves it, because we're undiluted for 2,000 years.
Well, and like that whole area hasn't had a ton of blonde-haired, blue-eyed, red-headed, green-eyed people forever, going back to the first Chinese records about the place. And the Ti and the Rung, who were the proto-Scythian peoples before there were horses in the region, were supposed – the Takarians and all those other light – I mean, remember the Chinese had a problem not that long ago with a Caucasian mummy that was in a rather unfortunate place from the standpoint of their ideology, because it's supposed to be Chinese territory. And then you find these mummies from people who had very – a Western looking skin. But once upon a time, I always tell my listeners, once upon a time, people were all spread out in pockets in all kinds of fun places for a long time. And you could find all that was what made Genghis Khan such a fun person to try to reconstruct his features, because there's not a lot of descriptions. But when you're talking about even the Ottomans, I mean, they would run in. You had your occasional Turk that shows up with the red hair and the green eyes again, you know, or I always liked that woman. And I'm old enough to remember this. There was a famous cover from the National Geographic, and it showed a woman from like Afghanistan or something. And she has the traditional features that you would associate with the region, but she's got these incredible bright blue or bright green eyes. And it was always such a reminder to all of us that people get around, right? And that these kinds of physical features have been mixed with people that we don't even associate with them being mixed with now. And with Genghis Khan, you could mix features of a person who looks East Asian with green eyes, with a beard color that looks more like what a Russian would have in the West. I mean, any kind of ethnic combination becomes possible. And so, I mean, I love that whole idea of how everyone moves around life. I mean, I don't even remember the point. I love the idea so much.
Well, I like that too, because it's the cracks in official histories, especially national histories, that we're all monolithically this way, but you'll always find exceptions and always find cracks and people who are there who shouldn't be there. And yeah, I love seeing those things too. Absolutely.
I have a counter question for you. Don't you think it's intriguing to watch something that I would have thought was going the way of the dinosaur, that whole, like you were saying, the nationalistic sort of histories, because it's on a resurgence in many places all over the world. I mean, just watching the Russians both reclaim their legitimate history, but also Davy Crockettify it also, just like, you know, I mean, all these countries that are rewriting their histories with a more nationalistic flair, it almost seems like they're going back to a way we did history 40 or 50 or 60 years ago in like the 1950s high school textbook version of it, just their country's version of that.
Yeah, it's funny when you're looking through the looking glass and you see on the other side, it can look silly. I mean, I spent a lot of years in Turkey and they have a very nationalist historiography. And
yeah,
my period is around the era of the Armenian genocide. And
I'm
probably going to lose some.
You're lucky to be here, man.
Probably going to lose some Turkish listeners just by saying that. But hey, it is what it is. But it does, you know, make question, you know, what we have in our system too. But yeah, it's sort of like a bizarre 1950s version in some areas. Something I was thinking of that kind of got me thinking, when you mentioned the Mongols, something you did really well in the series on the Mongols and then all of your series on the ancient world is you'll talk about these factors that hold true along long periods of history. You had mentioned the physics of the battlefield, that really until the 20th century, what it was like to be a soldier in combat could be very comparable to the ancient world when you don't have modern weapons, and getting into the shoes of the people who are there on the ground. And when you specifically talked about the Mongol slaughter of, I think it was Kiev or some city in Russia, or I'm not really sure, I can't remember, but that if you were in a helicopter, a news helicopter going overhead, what would it be like to see that? And what's your sense kind of evoking that of if you're on the ground, you have witnessed some type of total collapse, whether it's Mongols coming through and completely slaughtering almost everybody in a town, any type of devastating battle after Siege of Constantinople, 1453, take your pick, whatever. Is there anything that comes back to you and recurs to you? Wow, I get this sense of what it would be like to just stand there and see all this.
I feel like you have to read different kinds of things to get that sense that you're talking about and then apply those things to the stories in the past. So I'll give you an example. If you read the various chroniclers and they'll talk about the Mongols coming in and creating devastation or whatever they do, maybe talking about, you know, the fall of Baghdad, and the Islamic chroniclers would bemoan all the things that were happening, and you read this stuff and there's a disconnect. And the disconnect is what goes away in time, where these people in this story, you can in one sort of way feel for them, you know, because that's what makes the story compelling, right? You're feeling the emotions that connected with the story and the lives lost and all this stuff, but that's on one level. I'm saying this now as a history fan. I think some other people don't like history because they connect with it on a more visceral level. I think maybe the fact that I'm able to divorce myself is what makes the story interesting, right? If it were too real, you might not want to be so interested. But now let me take it to the too real area for a minute. As a journalist, I always wanted to be a war correspondent until I wised up and realized how stupid that would be. So I realized how stupid it would be because some of my heroes were war correspondents and I would read what they wrote. Some of the most disturbing books I've ever read in my life are those books. One of them is a perfect example. It's called The Great War for Civilization by Robert Fisk, who is a war correspondent, a modern war correspondent. The stuff that is in Robert Fisk's memory banks, in his brain, are horrific. And when he writes this stuff in the book, I'm a guy who reads Mongol conquest stories for fun at bedtime and never think twice about it. This was one of the few books I had to put down and make sure that I had some mental sorbet to cleanse my palate before bed, because I could not get it out of my brain. Because what he was essentially doing was giving you the kind of reporting you would have had on the scene at a conquest, like, oh, I don't know, Baghdad, or a tiny little sliver of a slice of one out of the way corner of Baghdad. And it is so visceral and it is so real, it makes you sick. It gives you a sick to your stomach feel. And that's the feeling you would have if you could get closer to those historical events. And that's what leaches out, so that when we read it later, it's compelling reading and interesting reading. I always say, I wonder how the people at the time period would feel about finding out that we're interested in those horrible moments in their lives in an almost entertainment-like fashion. And the only thing that makes me feel okay about it is that I realize that they enjoyed stories from the past just like I do. And it seems to be a guilty pleasure we all share. And now with our modern coronavirus, we're getting a chance to pay a little bit for how much we've enjoyed those kind of stories in the past by providing some for future generations that hopefully will arrive sometime to read about it later.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. I definitely don't want anything bad to happen here with coronavirus. I wish the best for everyone, so I need to get that disclaimer. Having said that, what this process will do is, I think, connect us with our ancestors in a way that it'd be impossible to imagine otherwise, since plagues are such a common reoccurring thing that happened over and over again. So now we get a little taste of what that's like.
I'm actually having that exact same emotion, and I was trying to cut a show this morning, one of my political shows I haven't done in a while. I've been trying to do it, and this is one of the thoughts that came out, which is, in a funny way, this allows us to have a little bit of an understanding of what it's like. You had mentioned the disease part, but for me, I'm feeling like we're getting a chance. Let me back up. This is the best way to do it. I did a show once on the second Red Scare, you know, the communist era, mm-hmm. 50s scare and the whole thing. And I talked about how when I was a kid growing up in the 1970s and we studied that period, it just looked insane. It didn't make any sense. You couldn't write about it in a history book in a way where we would sit there and go, oh, yeah, I see why it was that way. And it's because there's lots of periods in history where you get – to call it a mass psychosis is not the right word, but it generates the right sort of image in your head where it's almost like a crazy period, but you can't understand it from outside the period. And we said, wouldn't it be nice if you had like a potion that you could drink that would allow you to have the same fears, the same level of uncertainty, all that thing of the period that you wanted to study, and then you drink it, and then all of a sudden you go, oh, I see why they felt this way. Well, I feel like going through what we're going through now, and it's much bigger than the coronavirus thing. It's everything we've been dealing with for the last couple of years. I feel like you're getting a chance to drink that potion, and you're going, oh, I see what this feels like to live in an irrational era where everything seems a little nuts and where your kids or grandchildren are going to read the history books about the 2020s and think, why were they so crazy? I don't understand that period. But that happens over and over again. So when you say this is sort of like the devil's advocate looking at the bright side of the things we're going through. But I do feel like it's helped me on a personal level understand a few things about the past a little bit better.
Right. I like to think it'll be called the Great Toilet Paper Scare of 2020. That, no, we're not stocking up on food. We're stocking up on toilet paper. And
you're hoping it's not the Great Toilet Paper Crisis of 2020, in which case you probably don't have enough. And some people are going to be making a killing. The toilet paper, it'll be like the Carnegies and the Rothschilds. They would have, it's toilet paper money. You'll hear people say that years from now. Oh, they come from toilet paper money.
We've moved to a full prison economy where it's toilet paper, cigarettes, and a few other things too.
My wife said to me, she goes, how much money should we have out of the bank? I said, honey, if it gets to a certain point, this ain't going to be about money. It's going to be about, do you have any butter? What else do you have? We're going to be just trading.
It's exactly like prison. It's exactly how the economy works.
Exactly like prison. That's right. Prison, the national prison economy.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that things that look ridiculous back then of communist scares and whatever that film was in the 50s was I Married a Commie, I Married a Communist. And one time I was looking at German propaganda, and a question that came up with is how did the most educated society on earth in the 1930s, Germany, fall for what looks like so crude pictures and images of Jewish people with fangs looking like vampires, and then being able to transition yourself in that period, it could somehow make sense, like you mentioned with the potion. And kind of with that, I want to jump into the 20th century, because this is something else that your book focuses on, where you're connecting ancient fears to modern day fears. And that's how we can bridge these two eras and get more empathy for how people in the past would have acted. So you talk a lot about nuclear scares and common themes with the nuclear age and those in the ancient past. So what were some of those things that you saw?
I'm not sure which common themes were talking about.
Well, you mentioned the...
It's been a while since I've read the book, man.
That happens exactly to me, too. Once I'm done with something, yeah, it's gone.
I'm trying to remember what I said.
Okay, well, here's one specifically that I really liked. You mentioned the...
An example.
Yeah, the 1960 presidential election with Nixon and Kennedy, where this is a few years before the Cuban Missile Crisis. The doomsday clock is about as close as it could ever be. And the main issue that people have is, for voting, John F. Kennedy looks right at the camera and he debates, and he has better coiffed hair.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm there. I see it now. All right. Well, isn't it funny how that's always the case? It has to do with not being able to maintain the level of, I guess the best way that we phrased it is, if we were asking you what level of attention something requires of you, where would you put nuclear war on the list, right? If you were triaging the important things for you to be concerned with. Well, I mean, in a world where everything is equal, you would put nuclear war probably as number one, certainly like top three, right? Certainly on your triage list of concerns. But is it logical to expect human beings to be able to sit with absolute focus and purpose and paying attention to that at the expense of all the other banal concerns that make up our collective lives forever? I mean, that we'd use the metaphor in the podcast that we did on nuclear, early nuclear development, as all of us having a gun pointed at our head all the time. And the generation that remembers living without a gun pointed to their head might have constantly known it was there. But what happens when you're three generations into people that have never known anything but that? right? Can you properly give the attention that it deserves if it's something that's always been a part of your life? Yeah, nuclear war might happen, but my taxes went up $500 this year, and that affects me more right now. That almost is, again, you and I had talked earlier in this discussion about sort of the evolutionary side of some of this stuff. And I do wonder whether or not our ability to forget enormous potential threats is almost a self-defense mechanism, almost an evolutionary sort of self-defense thing that keeps you from focusing on things that could be apocalyptic, but probably won't affect you as much as something that's much smaller, but that's much more likely and more in your near future. I'm also seeing an interesting dichotomy between our ability to act intelligently as individuals versus our ability to act intelligently as groups. And let me just say, there's only been 9 million intelligent people over the history of the world that have already thought about this, so I'm coming a little late to the party. But this idea that if theoretically we had a system here, and part of this you have to understand, I've been rereading Marcus Aurelius lately, and it puts me in a dreamy utopian kind of mood about wise leaders with total power who, you know, and but you think about our best and our brightest, what humanity can produce in any number of areas, and you say, you know what, you put these people in charge, you give them the tools, and I have a feeling we could navigate all of these dangers that everything from the modern pace of change outstripping our brick and mortar framework, everything you could think of, AIs developed, nuclear weapons, all these terrible challenges, the terrible diseases in our future, global warming, everything. You put the best and the brightest in this country. I sound like it's the Kennedy administration, but you know what I mean. You put the best and the brightest, and I think we have a pretty good chance. But that's not how it works, right? Marcus Aurelius is followed by his son, who's an idiot. Right. So that system breaks down right there. Our system avoids the best and the worst case scenarios of a system like that. We don't get the idiots as easily, but we do get them. But we also don't get those people. My stepdad used to say the reason you don't get better presidents is because they're too intelligent to take the job. Our system doesn't encourage those kinds of people to get into positions of power and authority. And I would suggest that there are broad lessons that history teaches, not the kind that people ever use when they're using arguments or trying to make a political point, but certain things like leadership matters and poor leadership eventually sinks you. These are broad truisms. I had a history professor once explain the fact that the United States used to have a lot of margin for error when it came to leadership. 150 years ago, you got tons of resources. You got lots of land you haven't expanded into yet. You got lots of things to make up for stupid decisions, right? Lots of room for error. Fast forward to now, not so much room for error anymore. The price we pay for leadership that is not of a high caliber is higher. I'm not sure what a logical amount of leadership ability is to even expect. But I think we could suggest, and I don't want to single it out. People like to single it out to the last 2 years or something. This has been something you could make a case that, I mean, I would make the case that this is a mid-20th century and afterwards growing phenomenon. But it certainly is not the last president or two or three only. I mean, the imperial presidency was written in 1969, 1970, 1971, somewhere in like that. And I see a continuation of those trends reaching a point where collectively, for us to get out of this trouble, we're going to have to act on a level of intelligence that I know we possess as individuals, but I think the jury is still out on whether we possess it when we're acting as a herd. And so you had mentioned, you know, what we had talked about with Kennedy being elected because, you know, who did better at the debate or who's going to lower my taxes or all these banal things 2 years before potentially 100 million plus people are killed in a thermonuclear war, right? Did you elect the right guy then? If human beings die out someday, or I think Nick Bostrom described his definition of the words existential threat to mean moving backwards permanently in human capabilities. So, for example, if you could no longer put a satellite in space and you never could develop to that point again, that would be existential. I think if that ever happens to us, I think it'd be pretty easy to say we just weren't smart enough collectively. Put it on our epitaph.
Right. Huh. Well, to tie in a lot of these things together, with your book, looking at how humans approach existential crises, whether they're real or whether they're imagined, I like your honesty in the book that you mentioned this is a massive question and I do not have the definitive answer, but I'll put forward theories, because a lot of historians, if they can't give a definitive answer, then they just simply don't do it. So they're always focused on these micro targeted things that...
Let me stop you though, because this is a salient point. I had to argue with everyone I dealt with in that book to not state a conclusion, because they said it's expected, people will want it, it will have no focus without it. So just so you know, it may not be the fault of those people. There's a lot of pressure to state an argument and then back it up as the way these things are formed. But if that's the case, as you just alluded to, how do you do that about things that have no answers right now? Does that mean you can't talk about them until you personally come up with one? So I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it's actually not just a salient point. It was a huge bone of contention throughout the writing of the book.
That's very interesting. And it is something that, well, okay, if we can't have a solid answer, are we not even allowed to speculate? Then what can we do? But here's what I'm curious about. I suppose this is a bit of a value judgment on your part, but there are cases in the past where people perceived an existential crisis, or maybe not in the way you termed it, a civilization-shattering crisis that was the case. The Bronze Age collapse, somebody's society being essentially wiped out by Mongols, smallpox, whatever, take it. Then there are other cases where people's lizard brain takes over and they think, I'm in England in the 1600s and there's a Catholic on the throne. God will surely kill all of us. And maybe from their perspective, that was reasonable. But then we could look at doomsday cults and we could point at someone who truly is not acting rationally. Or as you said, the president with a better coiffed hair is what I should care about, not thermonuclear war. So are there cases in your mind where you looked at this society did a good job responding to a challenge, or they understood this threat the way that it should be understood and they didn't blow it out of proportion? And then can you think of negative examples too?
Certainly the most obvious in your face examples are the ones that pop up. I mean, the ideas, you look at the superstition connected to seeing conquistadores as gods coming back to, those are some of the real tragedies of history, but they're connected to these really human sides of us about tradition and prophecy. And I mean, you would talk about people always predicting sort of the end of the world, and you feel like the guy with the sandwich board, you know, that the end of the world is near, that if he's out there long enough, eventually the broken clock will be right twice a day, right? I think when you talk about examples of handling change well versus not handling change well, I don't, because the nuclear one is the one that always comes to mind, because it's really a question that you have to grade on a curve regardless. Because I would say that and when we did the podcast on it, we only focused on those really dangerous first like 20 years till the Cuban Missile Crisis, really, because that was, it seemed to me, like the child playing with matches era, where whenever you get hit with these new challenges that requires an immense amount of growth on our part collectively, I feel like there's some wobbling initially. And then a sort of stasis comes into play after a while where we seem to have – and of course, the downside of that is then you get complacent, right? We haven't had diseases for a long time. We don't have to worry. And then boom, right? But I do feel like with the nuclear one, it's a perfect example of – it depends on how you grade it. If you say we did not have a nuclear war, we did not kill 100 million plus people with nuclear weapons, we've never used a nuclear weapon in anger since, well, that's a high grade. If you say, did we manage to put aside our differences as human beings? Did we manage to act rationally, avoid the pitfalls that we normally do? Blah. You know, did we manage to not use these nuclear weapons like a club to browbeat? No, we didn't do any of those things. So it depends on your grading criteria. I tend to be an easy grader because you had mentioned things like the Bronze Age. To me, that's the curve I'm playing on. So if we're avoiding systems collapse and massive death, and Second World War, I mean, the thing that always scares me, and that as I get older seems more and more like a truism, is that idea that sometimes if it's been too long since you've actually smelled the bodies, that we too easily forget whatever lessons we think we learned. And I think in my lifetime, I've gotten a chance to watch that happen. And it's somewhat appalling, and at the same time, almost looks like a human evolutionary self-defense mechanism, like what you and I were talking about earlier. I mean, if you had to live with the trauma of the Holocaust, for example, in the Second World War, as recently on your mind as it was on people the year after the war was over, and then add to that all the things that have come after and all the things that came before as though they were fresh in your mind, I think we'd all have such collective PTSD we wouldn't be able to operate. But the flip side of that is, when it's been too long since you smelled the bodies, maybe you forget how dangerous some of this crap we throw out there willy-nilly and blithely at each other can be if it goes too far. And when it starts to go too far, you don't always have the ability to pull back and say, whoa, I didn't mean, yeah, let's bygones be bygones. Let's not go there. Sometimes, you know, if you push long enough, the momentum starts pulling in the other direction after a while, leading us to places we don't want to be. And then you get to smell the bodies again, and then it's rinse, repeat all over again, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And all the more reason to teach history. So kudos to you for doing so.
There you go. I'm just plugging the genre. This was all promotion.
There you go. Exactly. Learn about the Mongols. Don't let another invasion happen to you.
That's right. Study history. And now a word from our sponsor.
Exactly. This is brought to you by MeUndies.com. Right. Nope. Sorry. I'm not doing a live history for that.
History.
Done some weird host reads in the past, but thankfully never MeUndies. Well, I guess I'm never going to now. There you go.
Walled off that whole area of possible income.
Never planned on it, so I guess that one's safe.
There you go.
Well, yeah, Dan, thanks a lot. I mean, people sometimes are reticent to chew off massive topics, but that's what we did here. So before we round things out, was there anything else that you wanted to touch on before we close up?
Well, listen, I mean, you said it yourself. Part of what allows me to occupy this particular niche that I do is the lack of expertise. I mean, we can talk about this kind of stuff in a way that truthfully, I mean, if I could be grandiose for a minute, that I feel acts as a wonderful intermediary between historians and the average public, in the same way that one of the things that I think my people, journalists, have failed the general public over time on is our science reporting, right? I don't think we've done a very good job of reporting scientific breakthroughs and controversies and all that stuff. I don't think the scientists have failed. I think that the intermediaries that help connect scientists with the general public, which of course connects them with policy in a democratic system, I think that's all been kind of a failure. I look at my role and the role of people who do what I do, which involves a lot of authors who are not historians but write books on history and all these kinds of things. I think if we do our job well, our job is to help, you know, it's almost like I could never meditate by myself. I need help. I need somebody to stand there. And some people who are not naturally gravitated towards history just need a little help learning how to control their breathing and focusing on, you know, and all of a sudden it opens up that whole world to them. So, I mean, I think that the fact that you and I are able to talk about these massive, giant themes that no specialist historian would ever talk about now because it falls out of every specialty and involves all kinds of rampant, irresponsible speculation, I think that's what I do. And I think people like yours truly, I hope, help energize and appetize people towards these larger historical questions, because just like you mentioned, I mean, I think now is a wonderful time to see how it really shows us something about ourselves. And if you don't think it's applicable, go look at how humans reacted to the Spanish influenza in 1919 and how humans are reacting to the coronavirus now.
Absolutely. A lot more overlap there, but much lower death toll now. Hope it stays that way. We'll see.
There's no World War I going on, thank God, at the same time.
Yeah, we have antibiotics, so a lot to be grateful
for.
That
too, and ventilators, exactly. Some anyway, thank God.
Absolutely. Well, Dan, this is really great. I appreciate it. And you have a lot going on. You have hardcore history. You have your book. You have hardcore history addendum and other things. If people want to find out everything you're up to, where is the best place to find you online?
I'm on Twitter, you know, at Hardcore History, but you can also just go to the website at dancarlin.com. Usually that's how we do things. And then, of course, you know, my massive podcast, 2.5 times a year, the big one comes out. So we'll absolutely fill up your podcast feed with content on that. And we have the Hardcore History addendum feed, too. And if I can ever get my act together and record a good one, we'll get a common sense out again, too. And listen, I really appreciate what people like you do. I love what the podcast history space has become. You know, congratulations and continued success.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And thank you for joining us.
Anytime. Thanks, buddy, for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right. So that is all for the episode today. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, the McCrays, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.